Today on Maine Calling, gardening advice from top horticulturists. Late summer in Maine is glorious for so many reasons. A big one is the bounty of gorgeous vegetables ready to be harvested from gardens all over the state. However, this year, to put it mildly, has been challenging. Most of Maine is experiencing drought. Gardeners are exchanging tales of woe about their tomatoes, which are either late or stricken with tomato rot. Most lawns have turned a shade of golden brown, mottled with some green at best. And the weeds don't seem to mind. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, state horticulturists Gary Fish and Andy Brand from the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens join us to answer your questions about this particular gardening season. What's the state of your garden this time of year? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth. From investments to trustee services, more at WelchForbes.com. Maine Seacoast Mission, strengthening Maine's coastal and island communities through education, health, and support. Learn more at seacoastmission.org. And by Modern Pest Services, offering a non-toxic approach to pest control with Smart Monitor and Smart Catch Digital Monitoring. ModernPest.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It is a tough time for gardens right now with severe drought conditions in much of Maine. Today, we're going to talk with horticulture experts to get advice about how to deal with this and other summer gardening challenges. Joining me, Andy Brand, Director of Horticulture at Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, and Gary Fish, State Horticulturist with Maine's Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. We invite you to join the conversation. What are your questions for the experts? Here they are for you. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Just to warn you both, we already have a question coming in about aphids, but we will not start with those. We are going to start by talking about the drought. Andy Brand, don't have to tell you that it's been dry this summer.
It has been. It's, you know, it seems Mother Nature has been very stingy, at least in the mid-coast, with delivering us any rain. We've been dry for several weeks, and it seems like all the horticulturists have hoses attached to each hand. We've got the drippers going nonstop, and the plants are showing signs of, you know, distress. You know, they're wilting. Evergreens are losing extra needles that they typically wouldn't. You know, other trees, deciduous trees, are dropping some foliage in response to the drought, you know, trying to reduce the amount of surface area that they would lose water through. But we're managing, and the gardens still look lovely, but it's challenging, you know, for a month, especially this time of year when it's, we've had a week of, you know, high 80s, close to 90 for so many days in a row.
Andy, what do you need? What would it take to get the gardens back where you'd like them, healthy again? I mean, do you need 2-3 inches of rain?
I think days of rain, and not just, you know, the thunderstorms aren't, you know, so much of that water just runs off into our, you know, our drainage basins and such. So we need, I would love to see a few days of just nice, consistent, gentle rain, you know, where we get a couple inches a day to get our ponds are so low, you know, and our, I do have concerns with our wells. As I know, many homeowners probably are, as they're trying to keep their gardens looking nice.
Gary, I see you nodding.
Yeah, I think that there was a really good demonstration on one of the news programs yesterday showing an area that has been under this drought that was kind of in the mid-coast area as well. And they took a glass of water and turned it upside down, and the water didn't go into the soil at all. And then they showed one on Hadlock Field, which of course has been irrigated all summer, and they flipped it over and the water was gone immediately. And the point that Andy was making, I think, is a really important one, is we need many days of gentle rain to open those soil pores back up again. And that's what's causing so much problem for a lot of plants in the drought areas, is that there's just, even if you get a thunderstorm, it just runs off. It doesn't penetrate into the ground at all. And, you know, fortunately, there are parts of Maine that aren't under drought. Up in Aroostook County, they've had actually excess rain this year compared to normal. And it's really right now just along the coast and the southwestern part of Maine that's in extreme drought. And a lot of the rest of kind of western central Maine are kind of in the middle.
Gary, I know that Andy described what happens with the plants themselves, that we see needles falling from the evergreens, we see wilting, but this also opens up some other dangers, right? Certain insects will move in when we have drought conditions. What should people be on the lookout for?
Well, I think any time that a plant is under stress, there's more likely to be attacked by things like borers and other bark beetles and things like that, that find that they can get into a tree or into a shrub a lot easier when it's under stress, because the tree is not able to pitch it out, basically. And so I would be on the lookout for borers and things like lilacs and birches and bark beetles and things like pines. And, you know, those are going to be some issues there. And of course, you know, with any plant under stress, it's going to, you know, basically be able to not heal itself up as quickly. So it's kind of a double whammy.
Andy, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to add to that. That's exactly what Gary's saying, is our concerns too, that, you know, our plants are stressed and they are susceptible to so many insects and diseases potentially. But then also, if these plants go into the fall stress like this, and then into the winter, you know, they may be less likely to really do well through the winter. And, you know, we can expect some damage and death even, you know, that we'll experience next spring because of this drought right now.
Gary.
Yeah, so that's a really important point, Andy, especially for evergreens. Your rhododendrons, your pines, your spruces, anything that is a conifer or is an evergreen over the winter, if we continue to have drought, then you really need to give them supplemental water going into the winter, because those plants are still respiring through the winter. And every time we have a warm up, they lose more of their water. And then oftentimes you end up with severe winter drying. There are other things that you can do to mitigate that. There are certain wilt-proof materials that you can apply that are a waxy material that goes onto the foliage to help reduce that water loss over the winter. And that's another issue that comes from drought, as well as just the combination of drought and a lot of the defoliators that we've had recently, with spongy moth, which used to be called gypsy moth, and brown tail moth and hemlock woolly adelgid. All of those things are exacerbated by this drought. Another one that's just recently come is beech leaf disease. And that is really causing severe problems for beech trees throughout the Rockport, Camden area and up into southern Penobscot County.
Andy, let me ask you some advice then. I know a lot of people are bringing sprinklers out on their perennials, on their gardens, maybe on their lawns. Would you recommend people start, you know, dragging their hoses across the yard and watering trees, watering shrubs?
We've been doing some with, I would recommend, yeah, I mean, I would, if you can, if you have the means to do that. I do sometimes hesitate to suggest sprinklers, just because you lose so much water. I would rather see that water directed more to the root zone, and with either, you know, soaker hoses, drip hoses, or like with some trees, we've resorted to, you know, some of those gators where you can fill them up with gallons of water and have them slowly release the water, so it doesn't just run off the mulch and down into the ditch. And hopefully that will help some until we start to get some regular rains, which, fingers crossed, will be soon.
You know, I can imagine people watering their azaleas, watering their Rose of Sharon, watering, you know, their beloved shrubs. But if you have a large pine tree, a large oak tree, would you do the same?
Our larger established trees, you know, like in the forest and in those, we have not been addressing those at all. We're letting them, you know, hopefully they have sufficient root systems and the ability to withstand the drought. But it does give you a good opportunity to look at what plants are doing well and surviving and holding up to the drought conditions. You know, a lot of our native grasses are looking fine, little blue stems, panicums, they look great. You know, other native shrubs, sweet fern, Comptonia looks fine. Bush honeysuckle, deer villa, we have that throughout our parking lots and hasn't skipped a beat. It looks fresh and like you wouldn't even know a drought was going on. It's just happy as can be, you know, but it does give you the thought to look at, you know, what types of plants we can be including in our landscapes to deal with these drought conditions if they continue year after year.
I want to talk just briefly about tomatoes because, Gary, I was wondering personally why my tomatoes seemed a little late. And then I noticed that this was a conversation on social media as well. I was not the only person who was wondering why my tomatoes were late. I don't seem to have tomato rot, but it seems that many of my friends do. So tell me, what's going on with tomatoes?
I think it's just a really strange growing season. A lot of things started out fast and then slowed down. And then, you know, we've had such extreme heat, although tomatoes, you know, definitely grow well in southern areas and come originally from Mexico. So they shouldn't have a lot of problems with that. But the drought on top of a up and down growing season at the beginning of the season may have something to do with it. Beyond that, I don't know. You know, it seems as though we've had enough sun. If you're in an area where there's been a lot of clouds and you haven't had that much photoperiod, then that might also affect it. But I don't have a good answer for that one.
Andy, I want to talk about something fun. I mentioned a minute ago, Rose of Sharon. My Rose of Sharon's blooming beautifully. I've noticed many of my neighbors as well. So great to have something that blooms so late in the season. What else is blooming right now at Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens? What is exciting to you? And what might you recommend to someone who is thinking about next year and wanting to have something blooming this time of year in his or her garden?
Yeah, you know, you're right. The hibiscus, the Rose of Sharon's look spectacular. And then, you know, there are the herbaceous hibiscus that are just starting to flower now that, you know, die back every year, but they have those giant, you know, plate sized flowers in all different colors now, you know, pinks and whites with a red center and such, you know, some with nice dark maroon foliage with contrasting flowers. So those are gorgeous. You know, we're getting into the panicle hydrangea season now. The hydrangea paniculatas are spectacular. Native shrub wise, Clethra alnifolia, summer sweet is flowering now. You know, it loves wet soils, but does pretty well in average garden soils with really sweet white flowers. Button bush, cephalanthus, that's another one that's flowering now that all the pollinators just go crazy for. Butterflies are all over it. Cone flowers are still going strong. They look good in every possible flower color you can imagine these days. Those are just a few things just looking out my window right now that are really standing out and still doing well.
Gary, what about you? What do you recommend?
Well, right now in my pollinator garden, the big things that are coming are goldenrods, and those are extremely important right now for pollinators that need to bulk up before the winter. Those bumblebee queens that need to get ready for the winter. There's so many different pollinators on them that I can't even keep track of them all. Joe pieweed is another one that's really doing really well right now and flowering and tall and beautiful, as well as a number of different milkweeds. I've got swamp milkweed in my pollinator garden. I don't have any of the common milkweed, but those are doing well and seeing plenty of monarchs out there and people reporting a lot of monarch activity. There's a number of different mints that are, you know, producing flowers right now that are doing really well in my garden. And, Just a little story about the button bush. I planted a button bush here at my camp and right down by the water, and they must be a really favorite food of beavers because it was only there for about 3 weeks, and then the beaver came and took it right at the stump. So there's nothing left
Darn.
Behind. They fortunately left the clethra, which is flowering now and smells wonderful.
Oh, that's a favorite of my husband's. Yeah. Andy, what do you want to add to the list?
Oh no, I was just in. Gary touched on it with the mints, but it's the ones here that we have are the mountain mints, pycnanthemums. Okay. There's so many different species, but talk about pollinator heaven. I mean, it's just covered with our honeybees, and all our native different bee species adore it. And they, you know, the foliage smells really nice. It's nice and minty. Some of the monardas right now are doing really well. You can get those that have less chance of getting mildew. One of my favorites called spotted monarda, Monarda punctata, has incredible looking flowers, just amazing, just very, very ornamental. And there's the goldenrods, like Gary said, you know, people tend to be afraid of goldenrods and shy away from them because they fear that they're causing their itchy eyes, their watery eyes, and it's not the goldenrods that are doing it. But I'll let Gary continue with that because I think he can probably tell you a bit more. But plant goldenrods, they're great plants.
That's right. Everybody blames the goldenrod for the ragweed, but they are not responsible.
Correct, because they are pollinated by insects and they don't have a light pollen that blows around in the wind that would cause you to have that problem. I did forget to mention a couple of other ones in my garden right now. One is Helenium sneezeweed, which is just getting ready to pop some beautiful yellow flowers. It's a wonderful native plant. And then I've got a ton of sunflowers because I'm kind of crazy about feeding things with sunflower seed. And I have so many volunteers that you wouldn't believe it, but they're all, feeding the pollinators and looking beautiful.
Well, Gary, I don't think I've had you on the show since the state has come out with the new list of invasive plants that are not able to be sold anymore at nurseries. That came out about a month ago. Tell us about why this list is created and what people, you know, maybe ought to know. What are plants that are on this list that are pretty common and people might be thinking about buying or even have in their yard?
Sure. So since about 2006, 2007, there was a lot of discussion about whether or not there were plants that should not be sold anymore in the state of Maine. And over that period of time, there were meetings with the Maine Landscape and Nursery Association and land trusts and many others that all came together and agreed that there was a need to look at certain plants and decide whether or not they should be evaluated for their potential to be invasive. So invasive means a non-native plant. So a plant that was not here prior to colonization. And it has to be a plant that jumps from one habitat to another, that has some sort of an ecological, environmental impact or an economic impact. And in 2011, the legislature, you know, basically asked the department to put together a rule that would put in place the evaluation criteria. And then in 2015, there was the initial list of 33 plants that eventually came out and were banned starting on January 1st of 2018. And then in that rule, it says that we go through this every 5 years to review whether or not plants should be taken off or additional plants be added. And so we just finished that and we added another 30 plants to the list. I would say some of the ones that are most commonly used, one would be Calorie Pear or Bradford Pear. So starting 1/1/2024, it will be not legal to sell that in the state anymore or import it from out of state. Another would be European Mountain Ash is one that's been fairly common in the past. There's also glaucoma, which is a variegated variety of Creeping Charlie that's commonly planted as an annual in the spring. And probably those are, you know, some of the more common ones. Again, there's 30 total plants that were added. They were basically the ones that made it through the process. We started out with 173 plants to be evaluated, and that was quickly taken down to about 83. Then it went down to about 63, and then we ended up actually controlling 30 of them. An additional 29 plants went on a watch list. So in the next 5 years, those will be the first ones to be reevaluated, mainly because of climate change. And many of the plants that are on that watch list are ones that we don't think could be invasive in Maine right now, but they probably will be in the future because they're very invasive just a little bit further south of us. And then one plant got its special category, and that's Rugosa rose. And everybody's concerned about that one. I know it's beloved and it's planted for many years on our coastline. Unfortunately, it does become invasive on our offshore islands and in other sensitive sand dune habitats. And it wasn't banned. It'll still be sold after 1/1/24, but it will require some tagging or signage that will alert the purchaser that ideally it shouldn't be planted on the coast. It should be used in areas where maybe you need salt tolerance or something like that in a parking lot inland. And that there are plenty of other native plants that can be used, the Carolina rose, for instance, the Virginia rose, as a substitute.
Thank you for that. And we will post that list on our Facebook page. We are talking about gardening. What are your questions? 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are getting advice about your garden, especially with this drought-filled year for so many of us. With me, Gary Fish, Maine State Horticulturist with the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. Andy Brand, Director of Horticulture at Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. Share your comments and questions. I'm laughing at saying horticulture several times in a row on a Friday. It's sort of like an evil trick to a radio host. Anyway, share your comments and questions. talk@mainepublic.org is the email. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, which is where we find Steve calling from Freeport. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. Hi, Steve, are you there? Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I didn't hear. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I grew basil from seedlings, appropriate to the timing, and then transplanted them. I grow a lot of basil, and by now I would have thought I would know more about it. But this year, for some reason, the plants seemed very stressed out starting early, and some of the leaves have been eaten by something that I never see. And I'm just wondering, and I've noticed some indication other places are experiencing the same thing. Four plants I gave to my daughter and a planter look really great. But my plants look pointy and not happy with some of the leaves being eaten. I wonder if there's any information on that. And also, I'd like to just mention an experiment that I carried out that people might be interested in on garlic, how to store garlic. And basically, it's between 32 and 40 degrees in your refrigerator. I stored 5 pounds, and it barely sprouted at all a year later. It's just unbelievable. And so that was a great little experiment. Anyway, the basil thing, I'm really interested in.
Steve, the garlic tip sounds great. Gary, what's eating his basil?
Well, slugs love basil. So I'm wondering if it might be slugs, although I would think that he would see it. Beyond that, I don't know of any specific pests other than maybe Japanese beetles that are pretty common on basil. I don't know if Andy has any other ideas, but
yeah, no, I was going to suggest some sort of beetle. We've seen on some of our plants here, blister beetles have been chewing foliage, and that's a possibility as well, I suppose.
Another would be flea beetles. They've been pretty high in populations this year. But you would notice those kind of look like a birdshot was, you know, shot at the leaves. It makes little round holes.
If he has beetles, what does he do about them?
Well, first and foremost, I wouldn't say do anything until you know exactly what it is. So he needs to isolate what the problem is and figure out whether it is an insect or a slug or something like that. And until you know, then there's nothing to recommend, because there's no universal way of managing any of these things.
Steve, good luck. An email here from Sandy. I had a major outbreak of aphids on my common daylily this year. They completely died back before blooming. Never had this happen before. Do the guests know if this was a recurring problem in our area this year? And is there anything I can do over winter, soil prep, etc., to help avoid the problem next year? I'll turn to you, Andy. Aphids on daylilies.
I've never heard of aphids taking them right back to the ground like that. Maybe Gary has better answer on that. I've never seen that with aphid damage on a daylily. I mean, I would just go and cut it back. It should push new foliage. We here do very little as far as treating for aphids. We kind of let them just run their course and rely on our friendly ladybird beetle larvae to eat them up. But it sounds like she has quite an infestation.
Yeah, I would say that it's probably something other than the aphids that are causing the dieback. It could be there's a daylily leaf miner, but usually that doesn't cause dieback either. It could be, it's unusual, but deer might be eating them. The aphids generally are not something that kills a plant unless they have a virus that they're transmitting. So aphids can transmit a number of potato diseases and other plant diseases that will cause many symptoms that would be like wilting or the funny patterns on leaves or something like that with mosaic viruses and things like that. But it sounds like there's something else there. So she might want to look around a little bit more and maybe send some pictures to bugwatch@maine.gov or bring a plant to the local cooperative extension office and see if they have any other ideas. As far as what to do over the winter, there's really not much you can do about aphids in terms of trying to prevent them year to year. They're here, they're cosmopolitan, they blow in on storms sometimes. So there's really not a whole lot that you can do beyond, watering the plant. You can usually knock them off with a very strong jet of water, and they have a hard time getting back because most aphids don't have wings. They're not able to crawl back to the plant. So if you can use a strong jet of water that doesn't hurt the plant itself, you can knock them off. And you can use a number of different low risk, low impact insecticides that are either based on safer soap or some sort of horticultural oil.
I forgot where I was going to go just then. I'll go to Jan calling from Springvale. Hi, Jan, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to know what's the best way to get rid of bittersweet.
Andy, this is a very common question. If you can give Jan the answer, you'll make very many people in Maine very happy.
I can just say what we do. Luckily, we don't have too much, but we actually, most of ours, we do mechanical means. We get in and pull it, so we get the entire root system. And Gary can probably make other recommendations, but if you needed to use an herbicide, I find the most effective way is probably a little bit later when the plants start to take all their nutrition back into the root systems, is cut the stem and then paint the cut surface with an herbicide. And then it's directed just to that cut surface rather than you don't accidentally broadcast it on plants you want to keep, like some of your precious, ornamental plants. So maybe Gary can make specific recommendations, but that's how we would go about treating, our plants here. If we had to use an herbicide, we'd do a cut and paint method.
Yeah, I would just add that for anything like bittersweet or the other really invasive plants, There's really good recommendations for all forms of management on the Maine Natural Areas Program website. They have a gallery of invasive plants, and if you find the one that you're concerned about there, you can click on their picture and it'll give you a fact sheet that will tell you exactly how to manage it in multiple ways. In terms of bittersweet itself, it can be a long-term project because oftentimes there's a real seed bank there that will keep sprouting. So you have to keep at pulling them, the smaller plants. You can always tell when you've pulled a bittersweet plant out because it has really bright orange roots. And in terms of the herbicide to use, again, anytime that you use a pesticide, and an herbicide is a pesticide, you need to read the label carefully and follow the directions at, you know, exactly as it says. It needs to have a cut surface treatment recommendation on the label, and it would tell you how to apply it, usually with a paintbrush or something like that. So it's a very directed application. And in terms of the herbicides that are effective on something like bittersweet, it would be glyphosate or triclopyr.
Jan, okay. Thank you so much for your question, and good luck to you. And Gary, that reminded me of what I did want to ask you. You mentioned bugwatch@maine.org. So if somebody has a bug, they don't know what it is, they can take a picture and send it to that email address and get an identification?
Yeah, any kind of a insect problem, mite problem, disease problem, you can email. It's bugwatch@maine.gov, not maine.org. And we will, get it to the right person to have it identified if we can't do it ourselves.
Wonderful. We have a question here from Mary Elizabeth on Facebook. What is a good way to deal with Japanese beetles? We're going for the all-star questions today. Who wants to take that one?
I can do it, I guess. Japanese beetles seem to be spotty this year, and in some places they're much higher in population than they have been in others. First and foremost, I would say that you should know about the winsome fly, which is a parasite of the Japanese beetle. And when you look at the back of a Japanese beetle, if you see little white spots on it, could be one, could be two, could be three, that's a beetle that you want to save because it's been parasitized by the winsome fly. And over time, if you very strategically collect the ones that aren't parasitized and leave the ones that are, that have the little white spots on them, that will help you to manage your population just through that process of biological control. Beyond that, my first recommendation to people that hate Japanese beetles is to never plant a plant that they love. And there's a lot of guidance online in terms of what are the most favored species for Japanese beetles. Of course, they love roses, they love beans, they love lindens, they love peaches. There's a whole panoply of different plants that are basically Japanese beetle magnets, and you don't want to plant those unless you want to do something like a bean trap crop that you might put somewhere strategically in your garden to try to pull them away from the other plants. So that's another way of managing them. I don't recommend that you use the Japanese beetle traps unless you're really skilled in how to use them, because research has shown that those traps actually increase damage to susceptible plants, especially if they are not placed far away from those plants, and I mean really far away, and hopefully they catch the beetles as they come in from wherever they're coming from. If you're in the middle of a residential area that there are lawns all around you, they could be coming from every direction. So there's really no strategic way to use them. Beyond that, there are insecticides that can be used, but they're not very effective, actually. Japanese beetles and most beetles are very resistant to control by insecticides. And that would be something that I would recommend that you speak to someone at Cooperative Extension or email me at gary.fish@maine.gov, and we can talk about that.
Well, we are going to take another quick break. We are answering your gardening questions. Our number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back. And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program Summer Gardening, What to Do Now and How to Prepare for Fall. My guests, Andy Brand with Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens and Gary Fish, who is the state horticulturist. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566. Andy, I know that this is about to be a favorite time of year for many gardeners because September is the time when many plants go on sale at local nurseries. It is also a great time to start thinking about next year's garden, correct?
For sure. You can get a lot of bargains that time of year. Nurseries want to unload a lot of their stock. They don't want to have to overwinter it. So it's a great opportunity to plan out next year's garden even, you know, some things to add to it. You know, it's just getting back to our conversation about the drought, just be careful, you know, with any new plants that you start getting this time of year that you, as Gary pointed out, you give them supplemental watering, you know, through the fall, you know, until the ground freezes. So they actually get a good head start and get some roots put into the ground, because if the root systems don't get established, you run the risk of them frost heaving out of the ground later, you know, with the thawing and freezing, you know, alterations that we, you know, that happens frequently. So I would say just supplemental watering is really important for any plants that you buy right now. But yeah, it's a fun time of year, especially when you get into September to go to those nurseries and garden centers and find some goodies to put in the garden.
And especially in Southern Maine, you can plant some plants a lot later than I think a lot of people think, correct?
We have. I mean, we're fortunate. We are, you know, a mile from the water, from the coast. And, you know, we have mild temperatures for quite a while. Sometimes, you know, we get lulled into thinking we can plant very, very late. But it's just being real careful with the watering and care, you know, put a light layer of mulch down too will help. And I would say go for it. Yeah, it's fun.
Gary?
Yeah, I just want to mention one thing about watering. I've read a paper recently about people watering too much. And watering too much can be a problem. It's one of the number one killers of indoor houseplants, but it can also be a problem with trees and shrubs. And you don't want to keep their root system wet continuously. You need to let it dry out a little bit on a regular basis, because there needs to be a good exchange of air and gases as well. And if you keep them wet all the time, they'll drown, they'll start to get root rots and, you know, other fungal problems. So just keep that in mind as well.
Well, what would be a good guide? I mean, if you're living someplace where it really hasn't rained in the last month, would you go out once a week and water your shrubs?
Where it's been really bad drought, I would say twice a week and maybe even three times a week until that soil starts to open up. In areas where we haven't had drought, I would say once a week is probably good, just like you would with your lawn. You know, ideally with a lawn, if you're going to water it, which, you know, you can let lawns go dormant for fairly long periods of time, but ideally you want to get about an inch of water on it once a week. And as you go through the drought, you might do that in two waterings, or you could do it just in one watering per week. And of course, this is coming up the best time to plant grass seed at the very end of August into September. If you're thinking about renovating your lawn or planting a new lawn, that's the time to do it. It's not in the springtime. It's in the late summer, early fall.
And I know you're an advocate of maybe planting some things other than just grass seed, maybe some clover and maybe letting some other things grow in your lawn as well.
Yeah, most people probably wouldn't like my lawn because I have what's called a victory lawn. Whatever lives, whatever wins is my lawn. But ideally, I think that in the old days, clover was always mixed together with grasses because it gives it its own nitrogen fertilizer. It's a nitrogen fixing plant. And I, you know, would highly recommend that people consider at least adding clover if they need or want a lawn. And then there are many other low growing plants that you can add to it if you want to. And there are actually mixes out there. One's called Fleur de Lawn that has a number of different flowering plants in it that can tolerate the mowing. And those can be very interesting.
Andy.
Oh, I was just going to say, Gary and I would be good neighbors. We wouldn't be, you know, competing for our lawns to win beauty pageants. I have the same kind of lawn, just full of white clover, you know, red clover, even some non-native plants that have come in that I've left. And it's just, I don't mow as much either because of that. I leave the flowers and then just watch all the activity that goes on, the insects, the pollinators and such, or just love it. You know, even some dandelions show up from time to time.
You can still play Frisbee on it, right?
You sure can. Yeah.
Yeah. Andy and I are definitely, Andy and I are together on that. And I definitely mow around many of the flowers in my lawn and let them, you know, stay and feed the pollinators and other insects that are out there. And it's important to have a lawn in some situations to protect your house from fire and a place to play. But any more than that, I think, is really not all that necessary.
We'll go to Bonnie calling from Wyndham. Hi, Bonnie, go ahead.
Hi, yes, I have an answer for what's eating the gentleman's basil plant. I've had this problem for years and finally I figured it out. It is the Asian cinnamon beetle. They hide in the ground below the basil plant and they only come up at night. So if I dig around the base of the plant, they're about a half inch long and they look like a June bug, but they decimate that. And they've even found them underneath my marigolds, eating my marigolds up.
Bonnie, do you have a trick to deal with them?
Well, I just tried neem the other day. I'm not sure that that's working, but I've got enough basil to make a couple of batches of pesto, so hopefully it's working.
All right, Gary, what do you think?
Well, I've never heard of the Asian cinnamon beetle. I think, as I mentioned before, when it comes to beetles, very difficult to manage. So if you're going to use anything to control a beetle on basil, you want to make sure that you're using a product that's got the directions for use on basil specifically and gives you a days to harvest so that you know when it's going to be okay to harvest that basil.
Oh, shoot, you're cutting out a little bit. But Bonnie,
using it for food.
Good. I'm glad you've got some pesto out of it. We'll go to, let's see, Wendy calling from Yarmouth. Wendy, I understand you're asking about milkweed, as are many people who are emailing. So go ahead.
Well, I planted 3 milkweed 2 years ago, and I have over 50 plants now. And what has happened is I plant garlic in these two gardens where I put the milkweed. And I'm having a feeling that the garlic is contaminating the milkweed, because I've seen butterflies about a month and a half ago, but I cannot find any eggs or any baby butterflies. I had them the first year, but I haven't had them since.
Huh. I wonder if it's because... Well, gosh, Gary or Andy, I know we're plant experts here and not butterfly experts, but butterflies do move along. So I wonder if that's why it is. And or do you all think it has something to do with the garlic?
I don't think it has anything to do with the garlic. I think that it's just, you're not always going to have consistent butterflies there. And just as I mentioned with my own milkweed, this is the first year that I've had any monarchs on them. So I don't think it has much to do with the garlic.
Yeah, I agree with Gary. I don't think the garlic has anything either. I think it's just fluctuations in populations. And some years we are fortunate to get lots of caterpillars, monarchs on them, and other years not. I would don't give up yet. They're still flying around, and keep looking. You know, check those leaves and hopefully you'll find a few eggs and maybe even some tiny caterpillars.
We have good luck, Wendy. I have, this is kind of funny, an email from Rita, kind of frustrating and funny. I have a massive area of knotweed on the property we bought in 2020. My neighbor and I have spent more than $3,000 on excavation, natural herbicide, and a heavy-duty black plastic to smother it, but we still have a way to go. She asks, are there any resources to help financially with this massive undertaking, or perhaps some emotional support? So it makes me think that maybe we need to have a milkweed, a knotweed emotional support group. What do you think of that idea, Andy?
I feel for her. I totally, you know, we're fortunate here in the gardens. We really don't have any knotweed. That's an issue. But I know from my days in Connecticut, it's unbelievably hard to get rid of it. And it's just takes dedication and perseverance to eliminate it. And, you know, it's kind of like banging your head against the wall sometimes, because it's just lots of money. I don't know about financial support. Maybe a neighborhood group or something, if it's in multiple yards, you know, that type of thing. There's a local land trust here just spent a day with volunteers going along one river working on eradicating it, because it's just taking over the shores of, I think it was the Sheepscot River, possibly, if I remember correctly.
But Joe, yeah,
go ahead.
I'm just going to go to Joe's question. Hemlock woolly adelgid, any natural treatments to suggest? Gary Fish, hemlock woolly adelgid.
So for hemlock woolly adelgid, there are a number of biological control insects that are being released. So that is something that can be used and is potentially available depending upon where this is at and how bad the infestation is. It's not something that is just generally available to anyone. It has to be done through the Maine Forest Service, and it is appearing to start to have some beneficial effects in some areas. Beyond that, really the only control methods are to use insecticides. There are horticultural oils that can be used to help control hemlock woolly adelgid. And there are also other insecticides that can be injected into the tree or into the soil that are systemics that can help to control it as well.
All right. An email here from Jeff. We have beautiful hollyhocks that come back every year, but for the last few years, they have been plagued by rust. How do I deal with the rust, and how do I plan for next year? Andy.
Yeah, we've had the same issues with hollyhocks and the rust. And maybe Gary has a better way to treat it. We have not been able to find a good solution to dealing with the rust, unfortunately. We just kind of deal with it. We've planted them around our butterfly house because it's a host plant for different types of butterflies. But I don't know, Gary, you can help me out here.
Sure. So with rust diseases, generally they're not going to kill a plant or cause a lot of problems. They're more of an aesthetic problem. And they are related to an alternate host. And I don't happen to know right offhand what the alternate host is for hollyhocks and the rust on them. But we could do a little more research and figure that out. And, you know, maybe if it's a plant that you don't want, then you could remove that plant and it would help to reduce it. But rusts are something that generally are not a killer. They're more of an aesthetic problem.
All right. Wendy and several other emails want to know where they can buy milkweed. You all have any recommendations about where to buy milkweed?
Yeah, couple of them. Of course, the Wild Seed Project is one place where you can get both seeds and plants. Their plant sale is coming up here at the end of August. So if you're interested in buying native plants, you might want to look at Wild Seed Project online and find out about their plant sale. And they're starting to become more available at just about any nursery. You know, native plants are definitely becoming more popular, and you can probably find them in a lot of different places. Also, Maine Audubon has a native plant sale every year now, and they have plenty of milkweeds available there as well. The last thing I would say is that Wild Seed Project does have on their website a list of nurseries that do sell native plants, and you could probably find one fairly close to you, and they would definitely have milkweed.
All right, and I'm going to wrap with the question we get every year, but I'm going to have you answer it quickly, Andy. My mom has beautiful hydrangea that has not flowered in 2 years. Please help her.
My guess is it's the macrophylla, like the blue or pink ones, possibly. I Could be several reasons. Maybe they're pruning it incorrectly, you know, the wrong time of year, and pruning off the flower buds by accident. Maybe they're over fertilizing it, can often lead to less flowers and just lots of big lush leaves. Those are a couple of things that come to mind, or usually when I've talked to visitors here, that's usually what's been going on. Or they're getting shaded out. Maybe trees are getting too much shade, and that's leading to less flowers.
All right, try those three. And I want to thank both of you, as always. And I know that were so many questions we couldn't get to. For those, you can contact Gary. You can go to your UMaine Cooperative Extension office. So many options here in Maine. Gary Fish, Maine State Horticulturist. Andy Brand, Director of Horticulture at Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. Today's sound engineer, KG Akimuladun. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. You can visit mainecalling.org for our audio archive and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.